Hi, I'm Michelle Sawatsky-Coop, and it's time for another visit from yet another incredible human being, a hero in our midst. His name is Tim Frick. Wheelchair basketball is his game. In fact, he could almost claim it as his own since he is the winningest team sport coach in the history of wheelchair basketball in Canada and the only Paralympic coach inducted into the Canadian Sport Hall of Fame. And if that wasn't enough for you, he was also the first coach for Terry Fox and Rick Hansen. He played a part in both of their stories and both of their tours. So what was that like? Well, we're definitely about to find out. And we certainly know it wasn't without its highs and lows. So many lessons learned. You are going to love this conversation. I know, because I did. And now getting to share it with you is even more exciting. So how did Tim Frick's own athletic journey begin? Well, I wanted to know. So I asked him.
Yeah, I guess my entire life I've just been obsessed with sport. You know, as a little kid, you know, we our family came to Canada in 57. I was 4 years old. You know, as soon as I was probably about six and I learned about ice hockey and all the other things that are available in Canada. We lived in Northern Ontario. I mean, I would be out every day skating. You know, could skate on the roads there. It was so cold. We lived by a lake. I'd make a rink there. You know, I'd play baseball all summer. I built my own track and field set up with a pole vault and high jump and long jump pit and everything else in a vacant lot next to our house. You know, I would kick soccer balls against the wall. You know, I think I broke our stucco house walls. You know, I wanted to get good with my left foot because I was right footed. And I spent hours and hours and hours doing that. I spent hours and hours taking slap shots in our basement in the summer with, you know, the hockey stick and the puck. And then when we moved to BC when I was 12 or 13, you know, I was never a really big guy, so had to rely on guile, I guess, more than anything else to get by. But I remember going to the junior high in Parksville, and lunchtime they used to play floor hockey, but they played it with regular hockey sticks and a leather puck that had been taped up. And so I was, of course, new kid, arrived at school a few weeks late, you know, brought my hockey stick and I was the last pick. As soon as I got my first shift, I took a slap shot and actually put the puck right through the gyprock wall of the gym. And after that, I was first pick every time pretty well. But, you know, so sports really has been my sort of entire life. You know, my dad coached me in soccer and got me motivated to coach. You know, my first coaching gigs, I was like 12 or 13 years old, coaching little kids soccer and baseball and stuff. And, you know, I think every year since that time, probably with the exception of this year, I've coached a team or a group or a bunch of individuals in a variety of different sports. So, you know, sports has been my life. I'm lucky now that I'm retired. I can hike and I can go kayaking and I can play disc golf. And, you know, I still play a little rec volleyball. I played volleyball at UBC, of course. We had a great run at UBC with Lauren Cerullo as our coach. We won, and Tom Jones, who you would know. We won nationals in 76. Yeah, I've had a really lucky career in terms of sports. I've sort of transferred, you know, all the things that I guess I learned as a player. I mean, I was probably the biggest jerk as a player as I was a motivated player. But, you know, I learned all those things and, you know, and used them in coaching, all those lessons learned along the way.
Tim, talk about coaching at 12 and 13 years old. Like, what was there someone who suggested that to you? I don't think a lot of 12-year-olds would even have that thought process. And how did that come to be?
Well, we were in Parksville, and we had, like I say, my dad coached and another chap who was a real soccer nut. He was a Scottish guy. I can't really remember his name anymore, but he really had a passion for the sport. And there were so many kids that wanted to play that they needed someone to coach these 5- and 6-year-olds. And, you know, so I said, well, sure, I'll give it a try. I mean, I had watched, you know, my father and this other chap coach, and I thought, you know, and some of the local dads as well. And I thought, well, I know some drills and activities. And I got to tell you, though, my first day on the job, as it were, I was demonstrating a warm-up drill to the kids where you would dribble the ball, tap it 3 times, and then back pass it through your legs and to the guy behind you. And then it would go on down the line, and then the last guy would run to the front. And so this was a great little drill, I thought. And as I'm demonstrating it and tapping it back and looking back, boom, I run into the goalpost, knock myself out cold, and I wake up sort of laying on the ground like I'm in an episode of Gulliver's Travels or something, and So it had a bit of an interesting start. But, you know, throughout the years, I continued. I ended up coaching some high school teams while I played at high school. Had loads of fun. And, you know, I think when I was 16, I got my driver's license. Like the minute after I turned 16, I was down there getting my driver's license. And I had a little old Austin. And I think I put the entire baseball team in the car, you know, about 12 or 14 kids. And we would go and practice, and then we'd go, you know, hiking or up the river or something. It was a fun time.
So coaching must have been a natural fit for you. Do you have some big name athletes in your past? Like, if I just say Terry Fox, I mean, that guy is like a hero to all Canadians and around the world. And you had a hand in Terry's athletic career. Maybe tell us a little bit about that.
Well, you know, when I was finishing university and sort of thinking about a master's, you know, I'd been coaching high school volleyball and JV volleyball, and also ended up coaching at college as well at Langara for a while. Actually, Randy Wagner, you probably know from those days, we ended up winning the Nationals in 1980 for college. So you know, I was on this career path that I wanted to be a professional volleyball coach. I realized that because of my height and everything else, that probably wasn't going to make it in the pros or on the Olympic team. And so the only chance was to get an advanced degree and perhaps get hired down the States, because that's where they paid coaches. You know, in Canada, there wasn't no such thing as a paid coach in those days. You know, I was sort of on that track, and everything I was doing, taking all the courses and everything else, and, you know, reading, I read every sort of biography and autobiography there was on a great coach, just to see what it was that, you know, sort of made them tick and made them successful. And so I really was on that sort of path. And then, of course, I met this guy named Rick Hansen, and he actually threw a mutual volleyball friend, because Rick obviously was a good volleyball player as well. He was in the BC provincial program before his accident. After his accident was when I met him through Glenn Burrell, a fellow volleyball nut in BC. He was starting wheelchair sports, and he was looking for coaches for wheelchair volleyball. He wanted to do wheelchair track. He wanted a coach. They needed players for their wheelchair basketball program, because, you know, they needed to get at least 10 guys out to practice so they could run their systems and stuff. So, you know, Rick really sort of dragged me into that whole scene. I remember my first time coaching wheelchair volleyball, I sort of called the team in at the beginning of practice and said, you know, like, I don't know anything about wheelchairs or anything about disabilities, but I do know how to coach volleyball. So give me a couple of weeks. I'll run a bunch of drills. You guys don't like me, you can say goodbye. No hard feelings. You know, that was 1977, I guess. But then Rick heard about this kid. And of course, we knew Jay Triano up at SFU and some of the coaches up there as well. And we used to sneak into their gym in the summer to train, because, you know, it was an available area. And so Rick heard about this kid named Terry Fox, who had lost his leg due to cancer, and so went to see him in the hospital. Because our theory was at the time, man, is it ever hard to teach someone how to wheel a chair and how to play basketball? If we could just find a few people that knew how to play basketball, we'll teach them how to wheel a chair, no problem at all. And so Terry was our number one pick for that sort of process. He knew how to play basketball, and he just couldn't wheel a chair. So Rick recruited him and brought him into the fold. And of course, then Terry started playing wheelchair volleyball as well. And he came to our track and athletics practices and was training for eventually for his Marathon of Hope. But initially was training to go to nationals in track for amputee racing.
So you said he started training for that Marathon of Hope. Did you have a part with Terry and Rick in these big events that they decided to do? I would love just a little bit of behind the scenes on how that came to be for them. And I bet knowing them, you probably weren't surprised they wanted to do something so big.
You know, Terry, when he was out of the hospital for a little while, sort of, I think he had this incredible picture of all the pain and the suffering that cancer causes that he'd seen in the hospital, and recognized that he was maybe one of the more fortunate ones who was able to get out and resume an active life again. And, you know, so he always wanted to do something. He kind of kept it under wraps. Rick was kind of the same way. Like we used to have this fundraiser thing. Originally it was Pete Calistro that would wheel 20 miles and people would do pledges and stuff. And by the way, the first year I ran with Pete, the second year I cycled, and the third year I drove the van. But so much better and better, the chair technology. And then Rick kind of took over that mantle from Pete and did the wheelathons and the long distance races. And I remember Rick and some of the guys, you know, wheeling from Chilliwack into Vancouver, which is like 70 miles or something on the back roads. And I remember in Holland in 1980 at the Paralympics there, you know, when all the events were over, a bunch of the wheelchair track guys wheeled into Amsterdam from Assen. That was like 50 miles or something, you know. So when we were training for track, Terry would come out under the guise that he would, you know, want to go to the nationals and compete in some of the track races. And then eventually he broke the news to us that, yeah, he wanted to try to run, you know, a marathon a day across Canada. And so some of the training he was doing, he was basically doing it on his own. I think he ran like 100 days in a row of a certain, you know, fairly long distance. And, you know, we sort of, you know, got a hold of him and said, okay, let's try to put some periodization into this so you don't sort of burn yourself out. And so then he would come to our track practices and do some workouts in addition. So, you know, and I can remember Rick and Terry and I sitting around one night after one of our practices. We came back to my little place. It was a duplex that we rented or I rented. And I think I was having a beer. I don't think those two were drinking, but, you know, Terry was telling us about how he thought this would be great. You know, if every Canadian gave a dollar at the time, of course, it would have been something like $25 million raised for cancer research. And boy, could that ever make a difference. And, you know, Rick and I, being the jokers that we are, pulled out a dollar bill and gave it to him and said, there you go. All you need is $24,999,000, you know. So, I mean, we've got a lot of great memories with Terry and you know, his training journal that he kept, you know, during his Marathon of Hope was something that we had designed, you know, for our track athletes and to help you understand your sleep quality and quantity and your morning heart rate, so you'd know how your body was reacting and you know whether you need to take a day off or whether you could go a bit further that day. And, you know, when Rick decided he was going to do his Man of Motion tour, you know, it was really related to Expo, I guess, back in 86 in Vancouver. You know, when we left Oak Ridge, which was our big grand departure, Terry had passed away, but his mom and dad were there and his brothers and sister. And they gave us a you know, about a 1 foot or foot and a half tall bronze statue of Terry, the replica of the one that's in Thunder Bay. And that was up on the, you know, up on the shelf above Rick's bed in the motorhome. And, you know, throughout his entire journey all around the world.
You know, I think we've all been inspired by those two, but your close connection there. We have so many more things to talk about, but the last thing I want to ask you about those two gentlemen, what did you take away from that time that you carried with you? Because you had a lot more journey to go in the coaching world. And I mean, I'm just amazed. You've talked about coaching volleyball now and soccer and basketball and track. And, you know, you've had your hand in so many sports. First of all, you were confident enough to do that. But what do you take away from that experience that you had? I mean, what a special experience to be surrounded by those two guys.
Yeah, I mean, you know, there were a lot of personal qualities, you know, that I took from that. Like, both of them have this incredible determination. You know, you talk about asking an athlete to go through a brick wall in training. Well, they're stupid enough, they would have tried it. Like, you know, I mean, that's just how determined and how tough and how focused those two athletes really were. And the other thing is that their sense of altruism, their sense of wanting to give to the community, to contribute to society, to make a major difference. I don't know if they knew how special they were right from that get-go, but man, has it ever turned out to be an incredible, you know, sort of legacy for Canada. And, you know, when you talk about dreaming sort of big dreams, like Jack Donahue talked about, you know, there's a couple of examples right there. You know, I remember going to sponsor meetings with Rick when we were trying to raise funds to support the Man in Motion tour. And, you know, we always used to joke that these big shot, you know, millionaire CEOs, who we finally got to meet with a few times, you know, they couldn't imagine a guy wheeling across the street, let alone around the world. So, you know, the change that Rick and Terry made in terms of the way Canadians and people around the world view disability, mm-hmm. is pretty remarkable. That, you know, there's, you know, you can't really, you know, name any other individuals who have truly changed the world.
And pretty cool that you had the opportunity to touch that, you know, and be close to that. Talk about para sport. You immersed yourself really in wheelchair basketball coaching, right? I mean, you said how Rick kind of pulled you in and said, let's do this. And, you know, your learning curve obviously was pretty steep, but what are the challenges, differences, or is it more the same than we would think? Like those of us who have only played able-bodied sports, really, maybe we haven't even given it a lot of thought. So what would you say to that element of para sport?
Well, I mean, I would say, you know, my sort of journey is pretty simple, really. And people took a real simple approach without kind of overthinking. I think that would really sort of help. If I go back to my coaching philosophy, I'm thinking, well, you know, anyone can coach the X and O's and the ins and outs of the technical components of pretty well any sport. You can learn that stuff. Mm-hmm. But can you learn to coach people and bring out the best in people and help them learn to motivate themselves and get them to or work together in a partnership to have a peak performance? Like that's the, to me, that's the key thing in coaching. And, you know, I'd coached track at a few Paralympics in, you know, 80 and in 84. And I had, you know, and I'd coached Rick and Terry and I thought, well, you know, I've had a pretty good career. I coached, you know, a couple of volleyball national champions as well, club and college. So I thought, you know, I've had a heck of a career. You know, it's time for me to kind of take a break here. So I did. I was coaching actually at Selkirk College for a bit. And then, you know, Rick had this idea that he wanted to wheel around the world. So I quit my job and joined him and helped in the preparations for that sort of thing. And then, you know, I'd also had coached basketball. I think I had my level 3 in stand-up basketball. And I played wheelchair basketball for, you know, 15 years by the time I started coaching national team almost. That was it for me for coaching. I was done. I was quite happy where I was. Somebody phoned me up and wanted to do an interview for a magazine about coaches and, you know, what, and the focus was on coaching people, right? It wasn't the X and O's. It was that, so, you know, it was right at my alley. So I did this day-long sort of interview and I, you know, you're kind of fired up about coaching after talking about it all day. I get home and I get this phone call asking me if I'd be interested in, you know, perhaps coaching our national women's team. And I'm like, and I'm going like, oh man, that's like the worst possible time to call. So talked it over with my lovely wife, Jerry. And, you know, we decided that, you know, maybe, you know, I look back at the program and what I could find out about it from asking around. And cause I'd been coaching the RBC provincial wheelchair basketball team for a bit. And finally I said, okay, look, you know, it was the December of 89. I said, look, I'll do it for a year. I'll coach a team going into 1990 to the World Championships. I'll guarantee you we'll have a peak performance. We'll have a positive experience. And then after that, the program will be on track. And, you know, you can find a coach to sort of take over. And that lasted until 2009. You know, and each year I'd go, okay, that's it. I mean, you know, I got the program going good here and, you know, everything's fine. And, you know, then we went on that incredible streak, you know, starting in 1990 with that bronze medal win over the Netherlands, pretty well won every game right up until, I think 2004, we ended up losing a semifinal and won the bronze. And then 2006, again, won the world. So, you know, we had an incredible streak of all those years. And, you know, I used to always sort of say, like, you know, and I learned all these things from and stole them from all these great coaching courses and stuff and presentations that I went to. But, you know, I figure, you know, it's one thing to get to the top. It's another thing to win there. But then staying there is yet another sort of challenge. And, you know, I had quite a bit of experience at getting to the top, some experience at winning there, but none at really staying there. That was the challenge. And I had some unbelievable athletes and staff that, you know, came in and out of the program. Many of them stuck around for a lot of years, but, you know, not least of which, of course, was Bill Johnson. And, you know, I had a very special relationship. And I was actually brought to tears yet again in 2014 when Bill was coaching the women's team, you know, in Toronto, you know, at the old Maple Leaf Gardens. And I was doing a color commentary on the score table right beside the Canadian bench when they won the gold medal. And gosh, you know, that was the one dream that I had that was never able to personally accomplish, but it was fun to accomplish it, you know, vicariously through through Bill and Michael Broughton.
Well, you know, if you talk to Bill, you know that he feels you were a part of that win because of what he all learned from you and how he grew up in this sport with you by his side there. You know, it strikes me when we chat about the teams you've coached, and even if we, you know, you go back to even like, well, we won that national championship and we won that national championship, and it kind of seems to go with the teams that you've coached, and you seem to have really found a way to be successful on the scoreboard. Yes. But then you talk about how important it is to coach the people and the connection of those teams. And how did you get your teams to buy into each other, to bond with each other? And I hear you had some interesting team bonding exercises that you would throw in, and I'd love for you to share. And I know some coaches that are going to be picking up this podcast and listening to it because it's you are coaches, and would love to hear some of that fun stuff.
Yeah, that's boy, we tried almost every possible thing under the sun. I think first and foremost, though, you know, if you look at sport as a sort of a mental, a physical, and a technical and tactical kind of combination, I kind of had this idea that, you know, physically, you know, you can train and get fit, but, you know, it's hard to grow taller people, you know, midstream sort of thing. Maybe you go out and try to recruit some basketball player that has bad knees, but physically you're going to get what you get, and you can maximize it, and that's not too difficult. Technically and tactically, you know, you can come up with innovative schemes. And I used to love that part of coaching, you know, coming up with innovative ways for players to learn stuff, innovative ways to implement tactics and strategy. And, you know, our sort of philosophy all those years really was to try to have organized chaos out there so that we knew what was going on, hopefully, but the other teams didn't, because we never had, except for maybe one year, the best technical and tactical team, you know, and all that sort of streak. So that left the mental side of things. And I figured that most teams, and even today, even though everyone's got a sports psychologist, you know, most teams aren't really doing what they could in terms of mental training. And, you know, we broke mental training down into so all its major components. And one of them, of course, was the cohesion of the group. And so then we broke that down a little further, figuring out, okay, is it social cohesion? Is it on-court cohesion? You know, what kind of cohesion is it? And what kind of activities can we do to enhance those things? And so we would always, at our training camps, for instance, we'd plan all kinds of social activities that were sort of fun and connecting. And the other thing I realized early on was that you can go through like an entire season not talking to somebody on your team, like a teammate. You can do it really easily. Like if you're a bit intimidated by them, maybe they said something once that, you know, didn't quite jive, so you don't really want to open that up again. So you can go an entire season without talking to somebody. And that's kind of that sort of connection. We don't want you to be best friends, but we certainly need you to be able to communicate with each other, to be able to tolerate each other, to be able to unconditionally accept each other. And so we would do, you know, tons of sort of activities. You know, we did all kinds of things, like on the court, sometimes we do peer feedback. So we taught our players how to give positive specific feedback. We, you know, anyone can give hints and tips and tricks and ideas and advice, but we taught the players to give positive specific feedback so that when they see a player doing something, they could specifically say what it is that they did well. We also used to do these things called circulation, or in French, circulation, where, you know, the players would line up sort of facing each other in a big long line, and I would set a timer, and they would have a topic, and they would have to talk about it with each other. And then when the timer went, they'd rotate one spot until they went all the way around the room, and they'd all talk to each other. And everybody hated it, but everybody loved it, because once you got them talking, you know, you couldn't shut them up, like, you know. And I mean, it just went sort of viral, I guess. You know, we did tons of team meetings where we, you know, we worked on a lot of the team type stuff, team communication issues, team anything related to being a team. And we also spent a lot of time trying to make sure that everyone had clear and meaningful roles on the team, and those roles were valued no matter whether it was on the court for a minute or on the court for 40 minutes. And you know, one of the things I tried to do, and I think I pretty well did it most of the time, was I tried to get every player into every game, you know, no matter what the circumstance, and always found a role for that individual, you know, even if they weren't going to be a starter, or maybe not contribute too much, and you know, might be not that, you know, sort of level of a player to be able to play, say, in a gold medal game, but they could still play in that game and contribute. And I think that was a big deal as well. It wasn't just lip service. It was a meaningful role. So, yeah, we had thousands of funds and games and activities, and you know, we did things like we learned how to be active listeners. You know, we would sort of we went through a whole process of learning how to paraphrase and listen and you know, be understand before we were understood, and all those kind of concepts.
And I think too, like the fact that you would give that a level of importance, right? That connection, I think that's important. It is actually as important or more important, right? Than maybe the skills that, I mean, that would come, the hours you spent, that would come. You were going to touch the basketball. You were going to do those things. And I think that's really impressive. And I think some coaches need to be given the freedom and to be confident enough that it will make that much of a difference. Was there ever a time where, I mean, at that level, I mean, you're talking Olympic level, Paralympic level. These are the top athletes in their sport. Was there ever a time where you had an athlete maybe that didn't buy in? Were there some challenges you overcame? And did you ever come upon a situation that, well, you couldn't reach someone? Was that a reality for you ever? I mean, with all the success, it'd be interesting for me to know and for all of us to know how, if that ever happened.
Yeah, absolutely. I haven't kept a record, but I know on numerous occasions, you know, our best player was not selected for the team for reasons that relate to, you know, the team cohesion. Mm-hmm. And we always had this joke where, you know, if one player who has a big head leaves the room, someone else's head will expand to fill the void, you know, because, I mean, that's sort of just human nature. You know, everyone has their own self-interest at heart, and that's fine. And my job was to try to recognize that and appreciate it, and yet get everyone to keep each other's interests at heart as well. And, you know, for the most part, whenever we had somebody that didn't buy into our values, then they weren't on the team. And you know, the one or two times, you know, I like to tell people that we had 7, 8, 9, 10, I think we had 10 chances to win a medal. We won a medal in 9 of those 10, and 7 of them were gold, 2 were bronze. So the 7 golds and the first bronze, those were peak performances where everybody bought in. The 1 bronze and the time that we came 5th at the Paralympics, it was because of team cohesion. There's no other way of getting around it. We had the mix of individuals, for whatever reason, you know, just didn't work. You know, maybe, I know for sure, I thought at one point, I always thought I could fix anything, but I couldn't, and I didn't. And then when we, you know, when we had our final performance in Beijing, I think we underperformed there for sure. And that was definitely a team cohesion issue. And, you know, we made a decision as a coaching staff to take this group, hoping that we could mitigate what might happen. But, you know, when we got right down to the pressure situations, you know, it was like unexplainable that we couldn't win a game that we needed to win. You know, you watch the tape back and you go like, well, these are all the right players on the court. These are all the right plays. And it just didn't happen. So, you know, the power of everyone being, you know, everyone embracing your team values and each other, you know, just can't be underemphasized, I should say. And I think, you know, that sometimes you can win with a bunch of misfits, but I think for the most part, winning by design is a lot smarter than winning by accident.
Yeah, I would say so. I think it's great to hear that for coaches and just for people in general, athletes too, to want to become an athlete that contributes to team cohesion, right? And to know that that's important. And, but that's hard. I know as a coach myself, you know, you see this kid that walks in the gym and they're a specimen, you know, you just want all of that skill. And you know, there could be world-class on the outside, like the arm, whatever sport it is, right? All the ingredients are there, but if the inside isn't there, right? And we, you know, you talk about playing for the person next to you and all of that. And man, I mean, you've proven it over and over again on the world stage. Hey, do you have now on the other side, when things did come together, all those gold medals, man, seven golds, Tim, like at the world stage, is it even possible for you to pick? Do you have a favorite? Do you have one or two moments that you'll never forget? And you just sort of warms you up inside when you think about it?
One of the things that I'll always keep dear to myself is that pretty well in every gold medal match over those years, even though we had, you know, a core group of players, there was a different heroine every time that brought us to the top. And I could have never predicted who that individual would have been. But I think my sort of favorite memory, though, has to be Sydney, Australia, you know, because that's such a sporting nation. We knew, like, we had planned right from the get-go that we'd be playing in front of 18,000 fans in the Sydney arena that they had built, especially for the Olympics and Paralympics. And we also figured there would be a pretty good chance we'd be playing against Australia. And we thought, you know, like, if you want to be the best in the world, you know, you beat the home team in their own backyard. And that to me was a really special event, even more special because the coach, Peter Kaur, and I had become friends over the years. And, you know, we were great friends. We were also great rivals. To have that mutual respect was pretty special. But, you know, I can still picture that, you know, we had every player on both men's and women's team had family and friends that came, and they're all dressed in red and face paint and flags, you know, plus all the other sports. Obviously, basketball is one of the big draws towards the end. You know, we had a ton of Canadian support in the arena, and that was a very special moment.
Yeah. Wow. And Australia, I've heard from some other people, Australia did an incredible job of the Paralympics, didn't they?
Oh, absolutely. That was definitely, you know, they set the bar pretty darn high. And, you know, that's pretty well anyone who went to that event, that's probably one of their, if not the favorite.
Awesome. I wanted to ask you a question about Paralympic sport, in that I learned from Jared Funk in this podcast adventure of mine, hearing his story, how Paralympics works a little bit in team sport. There are different levels of ability and all of that. And how did you manage to have your teams mesh when there was that obvious difference? Now, on every team, there are some stars and some that are role players, so the levels are different, but we're kind of come to the court and we walk in and we kind of have the same ability. You deal with some other challenges that way, which are unique to Paralympic sport, I think, especially team sports. Talk about that a little bit. Give us a sort of an inside scoop there.
Well, all sports more or less have a classification system where, first of all, you have to be eligible to play in the Paralympics. And then, secondly, within that sport, a decision is made as to how fairness and equality, I guess, in terms of functional ability, is put into place. And Jared probably explained the wheelchair rugby sort of classification system. Mm-hmm. Wheelchair basketball has a similar system. It starts at class one, and then goes up in half point increments to 4.5, and essentially, if you're a 4.5 athlete, you have full range of motion within the wheelchair, full strength, full ability to rotate and up and down and all that kind of stuff, good stability. And as you move each half point towards the classification of 1.0, then that functional ability changes. And so someone who's, functionally a class two, for instance, you know, they're pretty solid when they get hit, but if they got the ball above their heads, they're going to lose their balance because they probably got abdominals and low back, but no hip muscles that can stabilize them into the chair. You know, a class one athlete probably, you know, typically paralyzed from about here down. So there's that core can't really sort of support. So any kind of bumping will throw somebody off balance a bit. not able to go forward and back without, you know, some sort of strapping or something to assist with that. And so when you're on the court internationally, 14 points is your sort of maximum that you're allowed on the court. And I only went over once, and that was in an exhibition game. And, you know, the whole team is looking at me, you know, she can't go in for her. And I go, yes, she can. I'm the coach. Listen to me. Anyway, technical. But nonetheless, it never happened in a big game, thankfully. But, you know, so the challenge is to, you know, to have all, to have your five players out there to match up against what the other team is putting out in terms of classifications. We would always go look at our five players and sort of say, well, where do we have skill advantages? Where do we have technical advantages with the typical matchups? And where do we have functional advantages? So we might give up a functional advantage in balance, for instance, if we've got someone who's got lousy balance but good speed. So we'll put them in a position where they can maximize the speed, and we'll minimize that the balance factors. And so we'll sort of try our matchups all the way down and see if we can see if there's a way we can win them, or at least if we're at a disadvantage in a matchup because of classification, say they have a class three out there and they're being checked by our class two, then our class two has to have the technical, tactical, and some other physical skills that can, you know, kind of counter what that class three has an advantage in terms of, say, balance and stability. So it's a, you know, for the longest time I had the little cards in front of me where I you know, I could see which groups I'm allowed. And then once I sort of got comfortable with that, then I had to start thinking, okay, well, if I've got a class three and a class two out there, and the class three gets in foul trouble and has to come out, if I don't have another class three who's a clone of that person, then I'm going to have to take out the three and the two and maybe put in two 2.5s or a four and a one, you know, and that, you know, those all give you advantages, disadvantages somewhere along those lines. So we spend a lot of time on lineup analysis, you know, especially against the top teams, obviously, you know, knowing what their favorite lineups were and seeing how our lineups matched, and saying, okay, what if so-and-so gets into foul trouble? How do we respond? We just don't sort of throw another person of that same class in there. I mean, sometimes you're lucky and you got a, you know, two or three class ones who are all equal ability and you can just interchange them. But for the most part, everyone comes with a bunch of different functional characteristics. And that's the fun part about coaching too, is, you know, the challenge of matching those all up and trying to get that little edge, you know, over the other team.
Man, a whole nother strategy. I can imagine the timing of that you're talking about, like who you've saved and who can go in and who can, wow, that's a lot to keep together. I'd love for you to talk a little bit though about the athletes that you coached. And now it's, I know you coached so many teams and I'm sure you had, you know, return amazing players that played on these gold medal teams at the top level. But I think for a lot of us from the outside looking in, we talk about challenges when we play sport and overcoming and training hard and pain and all of that. But it seems to me Paralympic athletes come to the table already having overcome so much. Do you notice that difference? Is there something extra special about them? Or what would you say to that whole concept? And I'm not saying that that's necessarily even right to think that way. You've worked with them. That's been your world. What would you say to that and to the heart of those athletes that are in the Paralympics?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I probably had a bit of a contrarian viewpoint of that. And, you know, starting with my first day on the wheelchair volleyball court, like I've always kind of believed, you know, if you're an athlete, you're an athlete. I don't care what your condition happens to be. I mean, you know, now we're learning about mental health conditions that affect athletes that are equally as important as physical conditions. So, you know, I've always sort of thought, well, if a person's an athlete, they're an athlete. You know, if they have some particular adaptations that are required, then I need to know that. And it really was no different, I suppose, in coaching, you know, the stand-up versions of basketball and volleyball is, you know, each athlete has their little idiosyncrasies. Each can manage stress in certain ways. You know, each has physical characteristics that will affect them, you know, one way or the other. So my job is to, you know, if you're an athlete, you want to be an athlete, you want to, you know, have a peak performance, you want to be your best ever, then I'm going to treat you like an athlete. I mean, I appreciate people have these situations in life where there's an accident or something and there's a lot of hard work goes into recovery. and all that kind of stuff. And that happens to pretty well anyone and everyone at some point in time. But, you know, we used to have a saying like, you know, if you were a bum before your accident, you're probably going to be a bum after your accident, but maybe it'll smarten you up. And if you're a great person before your accident, you're going to be a great person after. So here are the tools for rehabilitation when you're ready to play elite sport. We'll treat you as an elite athlete, and, you know, there's no sort of special kind of stuff. And, you know, I'm hoping that's what athletes would have appreciated about the coaching style that, you know, our coaching staff's brought over the years. People would often, it was funny too, because people would sort of say, oh, so-and-so is such a good athlete. How did they get hurt? And I'm going, I don't know. Actually, I never asked them, you know, because, you know, to me, let's do what we're doing in the moment, become the best we can be. And then, you know, there's nothing better than listening to your national anthem at the end of a Paralympics or World Championships. Let me tell you.
Oh man, Tim, I had a feeling that answer might go in that direction. And I'm so glad to hear it from you because you legitimize it. You've lived in all these sport worlds and you know, just mad respect for great athleticism, hard work, and the hearts of champions. And I love it. We're talking a lot about being unapologetically human here. And I think to coach as long as you did and, you know, to work with these great athletes, and there are obviously successes and failures, and having success, maybe we might think, well, that would make it easier to stay in it. But man, along the way, if you know anything about success at the highest level, there have been failures along the way. What kept you in coaching all that time? Like, what motivated you to keep coming back? And maybe at the end of that answer, you could say, what was the decision to then finally say, I'm closing the book. I think I'm good. I'm going to hand the baton over.
That's a good question, really. I mean, first of all, you know, like for all the wins, you know, I probably had 10 times as many losses. You know, I had some teams that had great players in BC here that we could never, ever win national championship. And, you know, those were tough, but I think, you know, one of the things that keeps you going is that you don't take losses personally. You treat losses and you treat failures as lessons, and you sort of build on them and you analyze them and, you know, find what was good in the situation. Because, I mean, you know, you could be great and just a lucky bounce one way or the other, and that would be the game for you. And I'm sure that, you know, I'm sure we had our share of bounces as well. So we really treated failures and losses as lessons, and we really took the, you know, what did we do well here, and let's keep building on it. And then, you know, we would obviously work on the lessons from there. I think the other thing is, you know, to show some relationship emotion. I think that was something that our coaching staffs over the years did, you know, sort of consciously were aware that, you know, we weren't these stoic sort of, you know, we were sure we were supposed to be the pillar of strength, et cetera, you know, but we weren't these stoic, unfeeling individuals. And that, you know, we spent a lot of time as coaches over the years, getting to know our athletes, getting to know about their lives, you know, really, you know, the first day back at a training camp after being away for a month or two, you know, there was a lot of chatter about, you know, life situations and family members and, you know, accomplishments and sorrows and all kinds of stuff. So I think those are important. And, you know, we weren't afraid to show that emotion. And you know, that picture is probably worth a thousand words. I think the decision to, you know, each year I obviously considered, you know, okay, I've had enough now. And, you know, that's what, and you know, I think, you know, when we're in Beijing and Bill had been with the team, you know, since helping us win in 2006. And he was really a critical member of that group. And, you know, he showed a level of connection and interest in the athletes that I really, really felt comfortable in. And I thought to myself, you know, if I'm getting a little older now, I'm you know, it's really almost time to retire. My wife had stopped teaching and we had our summer place that we wanted to move to. And there were a whole bunch of stuff I wanted to do, things like kayaking and hiking trips and traveling. And so, you know, it all just intersected nicely. Had somebody there that could take over the program and obviously did a great job with a bronze and a gold, and someone I felt comfortable with that could be entrusted with what we had built over the years. And then time for me to move in a new a new direction. And you know, I always used to tease everybody and say, well, I'm a guy, I have no conscience. So, you know, like, but, you know, I did obviously stay involved right up until 2014. And I still do coaching clinics and workshops for wheelchair basketball. Still, you know, coaching provincially. You know, my latest sort of fun thing was I found a player on Pender Island by the name of Katie Dandino, who was a superstar at college and university and had, you know, destroyed knees and wanted to play in Europe or pro so desperately, but, you know, the knees just weren't going to let her. And, you know, I told her about this sport called wheelchair basketball. I had wheelchairs at the school. She used to come and, you know, would play once in a while. And then finally I just had enough. And I said, look, we're having a clinic this weekend. You're coming over. I'm bringing your chair. You know, she's now, I think at the qualifying tournament for Tokyo, I think she scored 20 some odd points in the gold medal game, and they beat the Americans to win the Pan Am championship. So yeah, it's this ongoing thing, you know. Yeah. I might not be able to be there with the team, but, you know, the connections that we have with a variety of the players over the years, and obviously Katie's rather special being from Pender Island, kind of makes it all come full circle.
And it's really great. I think the world of sport's great that way. The role might change, but the heart's still there. And if you can get your hand in there a little bit, you just never want to quite lose touch because of the life that it really it's poured into you too, right? And what you've gotten out of it.
Yeah.
Tim, thanks. Thanks so much for sharing your story and just your thoughts on coaching and on team. And it just speaks to life and everything we do in life, you know, the people who are living next to us in COVID, we've learned that we're living with our teams really. And, you know, we haven't been able to do everything we've wanted to do, but I think there's real strength in that and to be there for other people and to really be a person that can, you know, be cohesive with those that we're walking this journey next to. And it's, that's awesome. It's just been great. And hey, where do you keep all your gold medal? I mean, you got a ton, you must have a ton of hardware. Where do you keep all of it?
Oh, well, my wife and I are just laughing because we just started going through some of the boxes of things that we've accumulated over the years.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of them. You know, there's a lot of game tape and a lot of medals and a lot of practice plans and a lot of stuff. I'm going to have to figure out what we're going to do with it all. We, you know, we kept these souvenir boxes of every trip and event. And, you know, obviously Jerry came on a few of them, you know, with us as well. I don't know. I don't know.
Well, you know, what a life of experience. And because of all that experience, we have some rapid fire questions to ask you, Tim. So we're not done yet. Not quite.
All right.
What is your favorite sound, Tim?
Well, my favorite sound, believe it or not, is the chink and clink sound that the chains make when you throw the disc golf disc into the basket. So the disc golf basket are the chains that hang, and there's a basket underneath. And if you, to make a hole in one, you know, sometimes you can't quite see the, maybe it's behind a tree or something, but you, you know, plan out the route and then you hear that clink sound. It's like instant eruption. And, you know, it's like somebody scoring a 3-pointer to win the game, you know, like.
Well, we touched on some of this a little bit, but what does being unapologetically human mean to you and why is it important?
Well, again, you know, it's all about emotion, I think, and being sort of genuine in that respect and trying to be that strong person for everybody, but also, you know, letting everybody know that you feel what they feel and maybe you have some other feelings too, that perhaps they can tap into. And I think that's really important in terms of relationship building.
Yeah, for sure. What is something funny that has happened to you? You know, do you have a favorite crazy story? I mean, of all the teams you've been on and all the people you've been surrounded with and trips you've been on, there's got to be something that rings funny for you.
Yeah, you know, there's like in my life, funny things happen all day long. And, you know, whenever something, you know, bad happens, we try to, you know, try to make light of it, make a joke about it. And, you know, we have that sort of approach all the way along. And, you know, I think in terms of crazy stories, probably my favorite one is you know, when I was coaching marathoning, we came to Winnipeg for the Winnipeg Marathon. It was Rick and Peter Brooks and John Lundy was there, who we just tragically lost, and Lenny Marriott and a few of the other guys that we used to have in that group. And I decided I'd run the marathon. I mean, I'd run, you know, 15 miles or something, but I thought, you know what, I got to run this 26 miles, 385 yards, just get it out of the way. I don't have to worry about that ever again. And so So I ran the marathon. I finished it in under 4 hours. Of course, all the wheelchair guys were like an hour and a half or whatever, and they're done. And so for some reason, Rick and I decided, wouldn't it be a great idea to stay in Winnipeg for a week and have a holiday? So we stayed in Winnipeg, stayed downtown, and each day we'd go out exploring different areas. And one night, and Peter stayed with us as well, and some of the local guys would, you know, come visit. And so one night there was a this kind of bar nightclub place that was having you know, that was really popular. Unfortunately, you had to go down a bunch of stairs to get to it, so you know, I bump everybody down in their chairs, and we get down there, and it's like jam-packed with people, and there's a few seats here, a few seats there. You know, we managed to sort of find some spots that were, you know, a couple of spare areas at a table here and a couple there and all that kind of stuff, and we got to know all the people around us. And And then all of a sudden they started up this comedy contest, and they were doing a comedy contest every week, and people would get up, tell a bunch of jokes, and the crowd would cheer, and then the winner would get a prize. And then all those winners would come back for the grand finale, and you'd get a trip to Hawaii or something. So we, and one of the things that happened on road trips a lot was, would be someone in their chair would transfer into an everyday chair that looked a bit more comfortable, like a, you know, a lounge type chair or something. And so then I'd come back from, you know, getting a drink or from the washroom, and somebody would be in my chair, but their chair would be empty. So I'd jump in that and just sit in their wheelchair and not think anything of it. And so, you know, a few beers went by and a few beers went by, and the contest kept going. And so finally the boys convinced me that, you know, if you wheel down there, and there was two stairs to get down to the stage area, by the way. So I had to, you know, they said, Tim, you can do it. Like, you've wheeled a lot in a chair. You can bounce down those stairs. And, you know, you got to go in this, you know, contest in a wheelchair, right? And so, you know, normally I probably wouldn't have done it, but under the influence, of course, bump down the stairs, get up there and tell a bunch of jokes. And, you know, I get a few laughs. Meanwhile, the people that we were sitting with at the tables and, you know, like our guys convinced them to go out and tell everybody in the place that this guy just got injured. He's having a hard time adapting. Wouldn't it be great if you had cheered for him and he won? It would be a real big ego boost. And so they come to the end of the night, and sure enough, I win. You know, it's an applause meter. And so I won a clock radio or something and a chance to come back for the grand finale. Thank goodness we weren't going to be staying there. And of course, now I'm stuck in this wheelchair. I can't get up and walk away. I can barely walk anyway because of having run the marathon without really training properly. So anyhow, we wait till the entire place clears out and a few trusted people that we, you know, we're sitting with. And then I jump out of the chair, and then we go and lift everybody back up the stairs and sneak out of there with our tail between our legs. You know, there's a number of stories like that that the guys probably tell it with a bit more aplomb, but
that's some great wheelchair humor. And I love that camaraderie and that fun. Hey, yeah. What does hope mean to you, Tim?
Oh boy. It's our reason for being, I guess. You know, if you have hope, you have direction, you have light, you know, that you can move towards. You have a basic reason to get up and get going every day and do stuff. And, you know, not all your hopes come true, but it's like that saying, you know, if I can paraphrase it, you know, it's better to have hoped and lost than never to have hoped at all. You know, I think that's what keeps us going. And, you know, without hope and without those big hopes, you know, life would be pretty boring and bland.
Absolutely. What is your biggest takeaway from the great pause of COVID?
Yeah, well, I got to start by saying I feel terribly guilty because I'm actually really having the time of my life. I'm out paddling more than I've ever paddled before, hiking more than I've ever done before. We're doing stuff, you know, around the house. I've been doing yard work and working in the garage and stuff like I've never had the chance to before, because normally I'm busy every weekend and a few nights a week even now. And so I kind of felt guilty about that for a while. But then on the other hand, I sort of thought, you know, like this has been really reinvigorating. Like, I've really had a chance to do a bunch of stuff that I probably wouldn't have done. And I feel good about that. I feel okay that, you know, I've had a chance to relax and enjoy things, and, you know, and looking forward to the next phase, whatever whatever the next phase brings.
Well, I'm sure it was a well-deserved pause for you after all the years that you have not stopped moving. Who is the bravest leader you know? Why is that? And what elements of humanness did they display and allow others to display?
Oh, boy. Well, I mean, I got to go with Rick Hansen. I mean, he's a really wonderful leader for a whole bunch of reasons. But one of the things that he really did was he, throughout his whole journey as both an athlete and now a public figure, he's maintained his own personal principles, and he's maintained his integrity throughout the whole journey. And I think that's been so tough. Like, I know that he's been approached by a whole bunch of different political parties and everybody else, and he just refused to sort of sell out to anyone. He's stayed with his loves and his beliefs and his dreams, and I think that's incredibly tough to do. I mean, it's way easier to sell out and make deals, but Rick has stuck to his principles. I think some of the things he's shown, obviously, he's a really humble guy. I mean, gosh, you look at all the awards and all the millions of dollars he's raised, the difference he's made in people's lives. I mean, people that 25 years ago would have used a wheelchair for their entire life, some of them are now walking because of the research funded by Rick Hansen initiatives. But he's such a humble guy. Like, he just, you talk to him and it's like the same old Rick. I talked to him the other day on Zoom, and it's like the same guy that, we were sitting around discussing training plans, or the next event. He's just that humility. And the thing that he's also done, which I wish I could be better at, is he shows gratitude for everything and everybody that helps him in his journey throughout life. And man, oh man, we used to do that pretty well on the national team in the short term, but Rick does it in the long term. And for somebody who is so talented and so accomplished, to constantly be thanking people for, and truthfully, it's not lip service, it's a real heartfelt, respectful kind of thank you. So, and then finally, between Rick and Terry and people like Marnie Abbott and all the other players that, we had over the years, I probably shouldn't even mention anybody because there's too many, just the power of believing in yourself and the power of believing in a dream and in a goal. It's just incredible what you can accomplish. And I remember, I still got the cassette tape recordings from my 1980 Langara championship volleyball team where I asked the guys around the room what they believed that they could accomplish and what we could accomplish as a team. And it's just amazing when you believe in something, it really, with every fiber of your being, it's amazing what you can do.
Absolutely. Looking around in this time of COVID, what's an example, do you think, of the best in humanity that you've seen during this particular time?
Well, for me, I've been doing an awful lot of looking around Pender Island because we haven't been traveling anywhere. And there's 2,500 people that live here. It might be 3,000 now because I think there's at least 500 have moved here to work from home, the pandemic in the city. But, there's so many programs on the island here. We have volunteers, for instance, that will do shopping for people that can't get out of the house to go shopping themselves, or perhaps are at risk and don't want to put themselves in the public. To me, that is such an honorable thing to do, to go and shop for somebody. I mean, I hate shopping as it is, but to shop for somebody else who you probably don't even know, and then to deliver that to that person, taking the time out of your day when you could be doing fun stuff. To me, that is, the best in humanity. And, there's a lot of people on Pender Island that use wood heat, for instance, in their fireplaces. And, I've got a few friends that that volunteer to go out. And when there's trees come down over the road and other places and people's property, they go and bucket up, chop it up, and then donate it to, people that, who are in need. And that's become really, I mean, they've done that for quite a few years, but during COVID, it's been particularly important to help keep people warm and fed. So,
finally, Tim, who are two or three people who have influenced you? And you've got some big name people in your life, but I guess two or three you'd pick, and how did they impact your life?
Oh boy, you know, obviously, you know, Rick and Terry are I mean, the thing that they taught me about awareness, I guess, and inclusion and that kind of stuff, and all the determination and all those great things. And, you know, they sort of dragged me along in their journey. You know, I always used to joke that the definition of a leader was to find out which way people are going and quickly run out in front. And that's basically what I did in that particular place. And, you know, there have been so many athletes over the years. You know, I'm going to single out Marnie Abbott-Peter, you know, basically who, you know, I sort of watched her career. I mean, she was a key player for us starting in 92. She was really an interesting player because she wouldn't hesitate to question any coaching decisions or ideas. Usually it was, you know, in private, but occasionally in a meeting. But her best skill in meetings was she would ask the question that she knew someone else in the team didn't understand what, you know, the coaches were talking about. And she would ask the question as if she didn't understand. And that kind of caught me by surprise the first, you know, time or two. And I realized that, you know, she obviously being in the room with everyone more, you know, and being in the dorms, she had a better sort of idea of what was going on. And, mm-hmm. and so she would ask those questions. And, you know, over the years, her and her husband, Richard Peter, have become great friends. And I've watched Marnie, you know, she coached our Canada Games program in BC for many, many years and single-handedly sort of, you know, developed our youth program. And now she runs this program that was coincidentally a Rick Hansen initiative originally called Let's Play, where, you know, they go out and they find kids in schools around BC who might benefit from using a wheelchair for sports. And they find that individual, they meet the families, they measure them up, they get them a chair, they get maybe two or three other chairs and bring them into the community so the brothers and sisters and friends can play. And then they follow up with those kids and let them know whenever sort of regionalized programs are happening for wheelchair sports and obviously basketball, but other wheelchair sports as well. And to talk to Marnie about that program, you know, I mean, her eyes just light up and it's really cool. So, you know, when you have that kind of passion and you can make a difference in people's lives like that, you know, those are people that I obviously truly admire.
Well, Tim, thank you. We admire you. That's why we put you on our list as a hero in our midst. And I am still kind of, I have the corner of my mouth is still smiling about your comment about being a leader, because you hurried in front of a lot of amazing people, my friend, to become that leader. And we know it was about a lot more than that. But I think in a warm way, I feel like you've found a way to really care about every single person that you interacted with, and you were able to become a world and a Paralympic champion over and over and over again. And I think it's important for people in sport and out of sport to understand that we can be unapologetically human, and that gives us the strength to be champions. And I think there's been a disconnect, and one of our goals in our project is to bring those two things together. And I mean, you've walked the walk. You don't just talk it, you've proven it. And now in your stage of life, you can sit back and say, these are the things I've learned, you know, let me tell you them so that you can walk sort of that same path. So thank you for that.
Yeah. I think, you know, when I started reading those biographies and autobiographies in high school, and it's continued throughout life, of course, you know, the one thing I took away was that these coaches, sure, they were good at X and O's and blah, blah, blah. But, you know, the ones that were successful in the long term had an intense personal interest in the well-being of the athlete at their core. And, you know, I tried to do that and tried to keep that as my guiding principle. And hopefully I did.
Yeah. Well, you sure did, because now you got a bunch of bins you got to go through that are filled with gold. Right. So. proof's in the pudding. Tim, thanks again. It was an absolute pleasure. I feel honored that I got to chat with you. So
thanks, yeah. Michelle.
And that's Tim Frick, former coach of Terry Fox, former coach of Rick Hansen, longtime coach of our National Women's Paralympic basketball team, and the winningest one in the country. Amazing accolades. But what stands out for me? The wisdom he has now from all of his experiences and how willing he is to share that with the rest of us. Thank you, Tim, for the human you are, a hero in our midst. If you like today's story, we hope you'll tell others about it. Share it, subscribe, and check out our website created by Shea Coop, heroesinourmidst.ca. Thanks for listening.